One of his admonitions gives a note of greatness to the sermon and provides a guideline for churches that may face a similar upheaval. Here I would particularly advise those that have adhered to me in the late controversy to watch over their spirits and avoid all bitterness. Then the scrapper in Edwards could not, even in this lofty moment, resist a jab at his old enemy, Arminianism, the dilute, liberalized form of faith that, in his view, made goodness too easy. The final moment had come. In a low voice, Edwards concluded, "Nothing remains but that I take my leave of you and bid you all farewell, wishing and praying to your prosperity. I would now commend your immortal souls to Him who formerly committed them to me. May God bless you with a faithful pastor, and may you, during his life, and that a long life, be willing to rejoice in his light. And let me be remembered in the prayers of all God's people that are of a calm spirit. And let us all remember and never forget our future solemn meeting on that great day of the Lord, the day of infallible decision and of the everlasting and unalterable sentence." Those who walked home from that service through the fragrance, the new green foliage of early summer, had an intimation that, however much they hated him, a great man had delivered a great sermon on July 2, 1750. After disaster, one must still face the next morning, and in going about the familiar motions, one begins to live again. You wash your face, heat water, gradually awaken nerve by nerve. In such small, homely motions, the body finds strength to go on. Then healing begins. So, in the first days of aftermath, Edwards tore into his cluttered desk to whittle down piles of unanswered letters that had come in during the crises. He wrote to Erskine and McCulloch in Scotland to thank them for their letters and presents. His prowling mind already had a new interest, for he included in many of those letters an enthusiastic digression about the new college being started down in New Jersey. The state's powerful governor, Jonathan Belcher, had begun correspondence with Edwards about this project, and many of the planners welcomed his counsel. Sarah probably did a delayed spring cleaning. In time of emergency, one doesn't notice dust on chair rungs, so her way of swimming back to the surface of life again may have been the way of any woman, hanging woolen blankets out to swing in the sun and setting small boys to picking beans. How to maintain the household was a pressing problem. Edwards' letter to Erskine ended with these lines, "I am now thrown upon the wide ocean of the world, and know not what will become of me and my numerous and chargeable family. I am fitted for no other business but study. I should make a poor hand at getting a living by any secular employment." The princes in Boston rallied around and worked up a market for fans and laces, which they encouraged Sarah and the girls to make from scraps. Sarah, still dragging around after her bout with rheumatic fever, had to use all her ingenuity to stretch the slim funds they had for running the house. Scottish friends sent a generous collection, but last year's dresses had to be refurbished, every scrap of food stretched. All the family concentrated on making the house attractive to a buyer, for that was their one hope for revenue. If Edwards had been willing to leave his denomination, many opportunities were open to him. A Presbyterian church in Virginia was so anxious to get him that they sent an agent all the way to New England to make him a handsome offer. the new college in New Jersey, angled for him to be president. If he had gone abroad, he would have been lionized, but he felt that his vocation was still to be a congregational pastor in New England, which he continued to regard as an experiment in bringing the Holy Commonwealth into human affairs. The unpleasantness at Northampton had been discussed throughout the colonies, and all over the British Isles, and the ripples of it carried far. One result was the first crack in the system of public support for churches, until then a custom throughout Western Christendom. Chiliab Smith, great-grandfather of Mary Lyon, the founder of Mount Holyoke College, strongly supported Edwards because the church in South Hadley, where Smith lived, had opposed Edwards. Mr. Smith refused to pay tithes to that church. He moved to a new settlement and started clearing wilderness. The fields and fine orchard that he had left behind in South Hadley were confiscated to pay for the tithes he had renounced. Smith and his sons contested this. The case took 10 years to settle, but finally the general court in Boston decided in favor of Smith. This set a precedent which opened the way for the historic separation of church and state in 1834. During that slow summer, Edwards composed a farewell letter to the people of the parish. He signed the first draft, "He who was your once affectionate, and I hope through grace faithful pastor." When he reread the draft, he firmly crossed out affectionate. While the Edwardses waited for someone to buy their house, the church in Northampton searched for a new minister. Both were slow and sticky procedures. By rallying publicly with so conspicuous a figure as Edwards, the church had made itself notorious. Though the salary it dangled was the largest in New England, except for the Boston churches, other candidates were skittish about getting into the situation. Not only did the committee find it difficult to persuade a man to come permanently, they even found it hard to supply the pulpit with interim preachers. Edwards wrote a friend, "The committee that have the care of supplying the pulpit have asked me to preach only because they could not get the pulpit supplied otherwise, and they have asked me only from Sabbath to Sabbath." The Edwardses had to go through an almost comic limbo when they were not free to leave, yet to linger was awkward for everyone. The church realized the incongruity of using Edwards as a substitute in the pulpit, so they gave up having preaching altogether to avoid using him. Hopkins says of Edwards's behavior in these hard months, "The calm sedateness of his mind, his meekness and humility, his resolution and steady conduct were truly wonderful." There was one cheerful day in the glum year. On November 8, 1750, Mary was married to young Timothy Dwight. A shaky Edwards, his emotions still close to the surface, witnessed the ceremony performed by Timothy's father, a judge. Then Mary moved next door and spent her life in Northampton. She never could bring herself to forgive the church for its treatment of her father, so she continued to attend services but would not go inside. She would sit in the vestibule in a chair beside the place where the bell ringer stood to pull the chimes. On communion Sundays, rather than share in the sacrament with people from Northampton, fiery Mary Dwight rode 12 miles to share the precious service with people in a different parish. Colonel Dwight offered to share half his income with Edwards if he would stay on as pastor to the families who had adhered to him. Edwards turned down this offer, though he found it touching, for he did not wish to split the congregation. The church, the gathered followers of God's will, was in his view still much more important than one man's hurt feelings. The house did not sell, and a new job did not open. Sarah stopped using white sugar and employed every imaginable way of using homegrown produce to feed the family. Then more personal abuse was heaped upon their financial anxieties. Holly continued to connive against them. Later, he was to express his regret that he published what he himself described in retrospect as an unchristian, a scandalous, abusive, and injurious libel against Mr. Edwards, for which I am heartily sorry and ashamed. Though Hawley's accusation was a flimsy contrivance based on his sick fantasies, it caused Edwards the humiliation of a public remonstrance. Finally, that fall, their old friend Hopkins maneuvered a call for Edwards to go as missionary to the Indians of Stockbridge on the frontier. It was strange casting for Edwards, but this unpromising move was to prove delightful for the children and the occasion for Edwards' greatest creative works of the mind. Chapter 12. A Season of Harvest and Respite. They spoke no more of the small news of the shire far away, nor of the dark shadows and perils that had encompassed them, but of the fair things that they had seen in the world together. J.R.R. Tolkien. In her characteristic flamboyant prose style, Esther wrote, "Among the bitterest of our experiences was to be sent roofless into the wilderness, but neither my honored mother nor any of the children bated a jot of hope. Though their assignment in Stockbridge was opaque, and the memory of the Northampton bruises still ached, the beauty of their new setting began a convalescence for the whole family. Their move was to a settlement in the glorious Berkshire Mountains. It bordered the Housatonic River, so clear that the patterns of twigs, pebbles, and ridged sand showed distinctly on its bottom. Here taut nerves unkinked, spirits woke to joy again. The area had first been probed by Major John Talcott in pursuit of some mischievous Indians. Then Samuel Hopkins had been one of the group who had negotiated with the chief of the Mohican Indians to start a mission on that choice site. The first missionary was a former Yale tutor, John Sargent. His commission differed from David Brainerd's, for Brainerd had been a roaming evangelist, while Sargent was appointed to settle in a single spot and build a parish. Timothy Woodbridge was the village schoolmaster and the mainstay of the parish at the time the Edwardses arrived. The land had been purchased from the Indians for 460 pounds, 3 barrels of cider, and 30 quarts of rum. That transaction turned out not to be a happy bargain for the tribe, who had the unfortunate Indian weakness for alcohol. In 1775, they sent a touching petition to an army officer. "We whose names are hereunto subscribed, being soldiers enlisted to serve in the provincial army during summer, beg leave to lay this request before you. We in our more serious hours reflect with shame upon our aptness to drink spirituous liquors to excess. We therefore desire that we may get so much as will be good for us, and no more." 4 white families were installed at Stockbridge to afford civilizing examples to the Indians, who were actually a gentle, domesticated tribe, chiefly interested in fishing. The trail of the Edwards family took in 1750 from Northampton to Stockbridge had not greatly improved since Benjamin Wadsworth, a president of Harvard, had described it in 1694. ye rode was very woody, rocky, mountainous, swampy, extreme bad riding it was. It has on each side some parcels of pleasant intervale land. A road of sorts led down into Connecticut, where iron ore had been discovered in Salisbury in 1732. This mineral was described as the richest this side of Sweden, and was highly prized for gun barrels. But in 1750, Parliament felt competition pinching the British iron forges and forbade America to produce iron. Left from the 45 mines around Furnace Village, now Lakeville, was an access to the Hudson River. This made a window to the west for the Edwardses, a link with the Middle Colonies and the new college in New Jersey. This was to be a significant fact for Esther. To the north was a forest so forbidding that Mrs. John Taylor, wife of the first settler who dared push up in that direction, apprehensive from her seclusion that she should become unable to converse with her own sex, used to go out and hold converse with the trees, according to local legend. The Berkshire winters were harsh. Edwards's contract stipulated that in addition to his salary of £6.13, he be provided with 80 sleigh loads of wood from the Indians and 20 from the white parishioners. The general court in Boston had chartered the mission, but money to run it came from British philanthropists, led by Isaac Hollis of London. There was a school of 55 Indian children and a church congregation of several white families and 42 Indians. Edwards could not speak the Indian language, so he had to lumber along with an interpreter as he preached. It was a strange employment for such a man, but it gave him the time and the tranquility for the sustained thought he needed in order to do his writing. Preaching to a stuffy room full of these Indians was a rigorous assignment in winter because they covered themselves with bear grease as protection from cold. They also used it to repel mosquitoes in summer. But they loved to sing, and the voices of the female Indians are particularly sweet and powerful. The women worked hard, raising maize and kidney beans with only wooden spades for tools and making baskets and birch brooms. They aged early, dehydrated by work and childbearing, so a woman of Sarah's straight back and springy step was a wonder to them. Edwards wrote his father, "My wife and children are well pleased with our present situation. They like the place much better than they expected. Here at present we live in peace, which has of long time been an unusual thing with us. The Indians seem much pleased with my family, especially my wife." The site of their house is now only a marker, a sundial on the lawn of an elegant sanitarium. But probably their home was similar to one still preserved, which had belonged to John Sargent, the earlier missionary. To pay for his new house, Edwards was forced to sell the land he owned back in Winchester, Massachusetts, where his father's people had originated. Turning to Timothy Dwight for help in unloading that property, Edwards explained that he was in greater need of money than I expected. He had gone £2,000, about $3,500 in debt, during the bleak final months in Northampton, giving an outfit to two recently married daughters, had also sliced into his slim resources. That first winter in Stockbridge, Sarah fell very dangerously sick, so as to be brought to the very brink of the grave. But she had an unshaken peace and joy in God, according to Edwards. Betty, the sickly younger daughter, seems to have caught the same infection. Then daughter Sarah Parsons lost her first baby, Ebenezer. Grieving for that loss, young Sarah drooped, so Elihu Parsons bought a farm near Stockbridge and moved to let his bride be near the comfort of her parents. In time, the lovely surroundings and the simple kindliness of the Indians made all the family feel that in this new location they had reached a resting place. Edwards and Sarah began a habit of strolling to the spot where John Sargent was buried near the Indian cemetery. The spot overlooked the winding river, the graceful hills and meadows, and while standing there reflectively, Edwards and Sarah began to be healed. Edwards started to tunnel through a mammoth project that he had long dreamed about doing, a work on freedom of the will. On Sundays, an Indian named David Nanakikuna blew a blast with a conch shell to bring the motley congregations to worship. If the people in Northampton had been stupefied by the erudition of Edwards, the Indians also must certainly have been. But they listened politely, sang with gusto, and were very generous to the Edwards family. When the first sturgeon appeared in the river and the Indians went out to catch them by torchlight, they would make a point of bringing back a fish for the preacher. They would set up summer wigwams in shady spots by the river and smoke the eels and sturgeon they brought back in their canoes. Some instinct for nutrition kept this tribe from scurvy, though they had no vegetables or fruit in the winter months. Their secret was the dried cranberries they kept to munch on through the winter. Furs were important status symbols to them, for the boldest hunter could flourish the most pelts. The smaller Edwards children found their new neighbors enchanting. In a short time, they learned the Indians' language and spoke it as well and almost as often as they talked in English. In January 1752, Esther wrote this description of their new life to her friend back in Boston. This town is delightfully located for winter sports. The river has a very quiet flow, so that we have skating parties, and the hills all around furnish coasting. I have just come in, with my cheeks all aglow and pulse beating wildly. My sister and I had two Indian boys pull our sleds for us and to guide them over the crust, which flashes like a mirror as with lightning rapidity we speed. At the corner, the woodmen sped with their heavily loaded wood sleds, and the sleigh bells rang out right merrily, as though it were a winter's holiday. Another time she wrote, "The chief place of social recreation and amusement is the singing school. Besides the pleasure of getting together, the singers are permitted to sit in the gallery on Sundays if they promise to keep to their own seats and not infringe on the women's pew." For Edwards, one of the best aspects of the move was the proximity to his old friend, Hopkins. Though Hopkins was often discouraged about his leaden parish at Great Barrington, where he had difficulty collecting his modest salary of £35 a year, he stayed there from 1743 to 1769. He often rode the 7 miles to dinner with the Edwardses and long fireside talks. Edwards continued to be a conscientious pastor to anyone who had to go through deep places. But his Indian friends did not expect a minister to make the conventional efforts to be popular or to prod organizations. Thus the pressures that had been on him before were eased. However, he could not bring himself to write a book he had projected about the nature of the church. That subject was still too painful. For Sarah, these were ripening years. Her household still required sensible leadership. They still depended on the atmosphere of love and gaiety she had a talent for supplying. But she had passed the time of having to cut up meat for one toddler and mop up milk spilled by another. The girls who had married had made happy matches. The younger children either scrambled contentedly about outdoors or, when indoors, amused themselves by reading and handwork. So Sarah and Edwards had time again for each other and the harvest of middle-aged love. Enough has not been said about the beauty of love in the middle years of life. By such a time in a marriage, the trying habits of one partner's have either been accepted or are no longer noticed, while the precious aspects of the other have become so much a part of the consciousness that they are like leaf prints stamped in stone. Memories both of happy times and of sorrow endured together are glued into the marriage. The ties between the two people are further fixed by the many years of jokes shared and the common body of experiences. At this stage in a relationship, to come back to the comfortable presence of the other after being out among many people is to be rested and at home. All of this comes only after there has been a profound tie of love. Without the love, the later years in marriage can bring ennui. As soon as she had the new house organized, Sarah began to be hospitable again. Her invitations were particularly fortifying to one lonely young man named Gideon Hawley. Hawley's journal, which he kept from 1753 to 1808, repeatedly mentions how good it seemed to him to return to the hospitality of Sarah's house after the rigorous journeys he made as a missionary to the Six Nations Indians. Saturday, June 1, 1754, after being sick as death in Cherry Valley Creek, he limply arrived at Stockbridge and says, "I spent 13 days very agreeably at Mrs. Edwards, in which time I saw Mr. Bellamy and other friends, which was very refreshing to me." He went briefly back into the forest, but returned by July 10, when he picked up a copy of Pamela by Richardson, which he found in the Edwards' living room. He was exceedingly delighted with it. It is truly very instructive. He stayed to hear Edwards preach on John 10:27, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." And when he spent Monday still deep in Pamela, Hawley left at last on the 17th. It is not surprising that, after such a refreshing holiday, he wrote, "Set out on journey to Boston, had some agreeable thoughts on road. By August 20, he was back in Stockbridge, filled the pulpit for Edwards, and stayed 10 days. He needed these respites, for his efforts among the Indians were discouraging. He analyzed the trouble. "Lately, Indians have been very much afraid of English or white people settling here, which they are very much against. They are sensible of the grasping dispositions of white people." When he returned to Stockbridge in April 1755, Hawley found Sarah entertaining another guest, John Hamlin, but they warmly made room for Hawley, and the next day Edwards, Hamlin, and Jonathan Jr., Hawley's stoutest admirer and shadow among the children, rode a bit of the way into the forest with Hawley before he resumed his lonely journeys. He now had the Stockbridge habit chronically, and he returned in August for 10 more days. His diary is in a joggled scrawl, as if he had written it while on horseback or before the unsteady light of a campfire. It reveals that this young man was more than a little a poet, and that he had a far-sighted concept of the oneness of humanity. Here is a sample passage. Asked Chief to let me have a path to his town, and if he ever saw me coming over the mountains, he would not, I hope, shut a door against me. I told him, the smoke of our fires mist together in the same air. We drank of the same water and lived upon the same food, and therefore that be glad we might in every respect to be one and spend a happy immortality together. It meant a great deal to this sensitive young man to have the interludes in the warmth of Sarah Edwards's hospitality. They offset the times of discouragement, like the February day in 1756 when he wrote, "The week aft, I have done little for God. Oh, how time slips away and nothing done." So once more Sarah, simply by being herself, affected the life of another. Edwards rigged up a study in a closet 7 by 3 feet, where he had a hexagonal table with inclining leaves, so as Esther described it, he can have his books of reference before his eyes all at once and can leave them open at the passage where he leaves off. The chair he used is still at Princeton, with one rung worn down as if he had propped one leg on it to write on a pad balanced on his knee. At last he could start on a book he had described in October 1748, but been remarkably hindered in completing. The result was Freedom of the Will, published in Boston in 1754. Proofreading this tome was so formidable a task that the first printer confessed he gave only a cursory review to these sheets. Many snowy Stockbridge nights, Sarah must have brought out her knitting to help keep her awake. As her husband read aloud to her the product of the day's skull-cracking sessions in his study. It is a monumental work of reasoning, though it has occasional human lapses, such as Edwards's habit of transmitting quotations loosely and changing tenses if it suited him. He was still brooding about his humiliation at Northampton when he closed this work with the Bible line, "God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty, and the things which are despised hath God chosen." From his hilly nook, Edwards also managed to be in the midst of a new enterprise in New Jersey, one that was to affect the Edwards family in a personal way, as well as to color the intellectual history of America. A new college had been formed to be the voice of true religion in the colonies. It was younger and more religiously committed than the battered institutions in Cambridge and New Haven. Individual Scots contributed so enthusiastically to the project that the school was called the Young Daughter of the Church of Scotland. The founding impetus for the school was an effort to spell out in the training of human lives the philosophy of which Edwards was the most prominent spokesman. The trail of the new college goes back to the Edwardses in other ways. For as one early president stated, "If it had not been for the treatment received by Mr. Brainerd at Yale College, New Jersey College would never have been erected." Everywhere then the wind was full of talk of new colleges. Franklin agitated for a university in Philadelphia in 1749. In the settling of new countries, the first care must be to secure the necessaries of life. This engrosses their attention and affords them little time to think of anything further. The culture of minds by the finer arts and sciences was necessarily postponed to times of more wealth and leisure. These times are come. A similar notion led a group of men in New York to start King's College, later Columbia, with proceeds from the sale of 10,000 lottery tickets. New Jersey was ripe for a school. By 1749, its population was described as the most easy and happy people of any colony in North America. Prospering as a busy corridor for movement of products between New York and Philadelphia, the state was also fortunate because no powerful Indian tribes threatened its borders. The resident Indians were 5,000 to 8,000 placid Lenapes who had enough large woodlands to range so that they were contented and untroublesome. Because they did not need to spend money on military defenses, New Jerseyans enjoyed delightfully low taxes. The Board of Trade bragged in 1749 that 'tis 17 years since any tax was raised on the people for the support of the government. The colony paid its expenses almost entirely from interest on loans made to settlers for improving their lands. There was a brief scuffle in 1755 when New Jersey and Connecticut disputed over one northern parcel of land, and once in Essex County, there was a shady transaction in land which was sold two and three times over. But in general, life smiled on New Jersey. The state was an oddity culturally. West Jersey was influenced by Quaker Pennsylvania, while East Jersey was Dutch and Scottish. The General Assembly recognized this cleavage and ultimately met at Perth Amboy in the east, then at Burlington in the western bogs. Even the currency reflected the difference. A Spanish milled dollar was worth more in the west of the state than in the east. Happily fattened on the export of meat and timber, the state could easily afford a luxury like its own college. The sedate Jersey Presbyterians had been scandalized by the goings-on in other schools that they heard about. Harvard boys were fined for climbing the college roofs and for stealing geese from the town poultry yards, then roasting them over fires in their rooms as a protest against the dull dining room meals. Peasley Collins, class of 1747, was fined for making tumultuous noises, and when ordered to stand and be admonished, he smiled and fleered in a most contemptuous manner. Yale was just as rowdy, and it was reported that the college shamefully neglected the study of Hebrew. In conversations over lunch tables at Yale alumni gatherings, the friends of Edwards discussed the need for a school in New Jersey. One of the planners was a short, cheery aristocrat, the son of a judge in Fairfield, Connecticut. His name was Aaron Burr, but he was not the notorious one of history. This Burr had been a Yale classmate of David Brainerd, who had introduced him to Edwards. He was independently rich and had uncommon powers in conversation, warm affections, was fair, open, and honorable. One stout partisan of Burr was Judge William Livingston, member of the baronial family who had enormous holdings in New York and Vermont. The judge later became governor of New Jersey and the father-in-law of John Jay. Livingston had been in the same group at Yale as Burr, and as he confessed, "I still seem to be in a rapture whenever I meet with a person whom I knew in college." As Livingston described Burr, "In him everything was agreeable, everything natural. He inspired all around him with innocent cheerfulness." Burr had been minister of the First Church in Newark, a town founded in 1666 by three boatloads of people who had left Connecticut, partly to get away from the harsh east winds, and partly in pique because a royal charter had united the colonies of New Haven and Connecticut. They had bought from the Sagamore Indians an attractive site on the Passaic River, then a clear stream where children could skate in winter, canoe in summer. This transaction was so tactful that an old Indian said, "Not a drop of our blood have you spilled in battle. Not an acre of our land have you taken without our consent." By 1716, the town had outgrown its first meeting house. When Burr came in 1736, he preached in a new 44-foot square stone building that was considered very grand for that day. The church's treasure was a sublimely fashioned baptismal bowl, which the family of Deacon Azariah Crane had brought from England 100 years earlier and used for bridal feasts before it was given to the church in 1730. The convivial Burr would have appreciated the bowl both as a symbol of celebration and of ceremony. The congregation was devoted to their dashing minister, and through all his ministry there subsisted between them the most entire harmony. When the new college was chartered, Burr enthusiastically voted for Jonathan Dickinson to be its first president. Dickinson, a leader of the synod, had been tutoring six boys in his church in neighboring Elizabethtown, and these boys became the first class in the new college. Brainerd had come down to officiate at the wedding when, in 1747, Dickinson, aged 59, was married to a girl of 27. But then Dickinson unexpectedly died after only 4.5 months in his post as president. The trustees agreed with Livingston that Burr was indeed most remarkably qualified for presiding over that grand undertaking. So he was unanimously chosen in November 1748. Burr's charm had even permeated the crusty Thomas Clapp, who tried to entice him to First Church in New Haven because he was annoyed by Joseph Noyes, its minister. Our plot thickens here. Noyes's wife was Sarah Edwards' stepsister, the one daughter James Pierpont had produced by his second wife. After her death, he had married Mary Hooker, Sarah's mother. Clapp tried to have Noyes removed on heresy charges, but Noyes had replied, "I am too old to be catechized," and simply refused to attend hearings. The Yale Corporation decided to let Mr. Noyes die in peace, and a member of the corporation to his death.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail-order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle is adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.